Well, I'm glad you've come to some warm fellowship on this cool night. Don't appreciate it as much in the summer. Psalm 39 that we're going to look at tonight, I think, is often misconstrued, and so I trust that as we go through it, the clarity of what God is conveying to us will just become real in your life. Clearly, that's the hope in all of these psalms, isn't it? As it begins to deal in every case with some kind of emotion, usually an issue or something that has happened, a circumstance that has come into his life, has caused him to feel a certain way, and within the psalm, that feeling is being revealed as well as the solution to finding relief in most cases. When we look at Psalm 39, to me it's impossible to really understand it without taking into consideration Psalm 37 and 38. I believe that they go together. I guess some theologians may argue with me about that, but the more I saw and studied it, the more it was so obvious. So we're going to be bringing in Psalm 38, Psalm 37, Psalm 38 into Psalm 39, hopefully to help you understand a little bit better. At the beginning of Psalm chapter 38, it's telling us that you and I have a tendency to look at what is happening in the physical world and in many respects find ourselves almost envious of people that could possibly be doing the wrong thing. We don't understand why they could be successful at any point in time, and it is upsetting to us. He begins to deal with that upset, and he takes our focus and he says, you know what you need to do? You need to delight yourself in the Lord. Quit delighting yourself in this stuff. Believe that God will give you the desires of your heart if you do that. Of course, throughout Psalm 37, he begins to give us an interesting contrast, and I want you to, this contrast that we saw before, but when he begins to talk about and use this phrase, cultivate faithfulness, he then ties it directly to the cultivation of land. And his point is that you'll inherit this land. Now, the question is, what kind of land are we inheriting? And as we talked about, we are inheriting eternal land. We are inheriting eternal things. So the things that we're cultivating are everlasting. It is in stark contrast to the temporary. And he demonstrates that throughout. If you look with me in Psalm 37, he says in verse 3, trust in the Lord, do good, dwell in the land. So we know that we're dealing with that kind of metaphor. Dwell in the land, cultivate faithfulness. So we're cultivating something. If you drop it down a little bit further, it says in verse 9, evildoers will be cut off. So there's the temporary contrast. But those who wait for the Lord will inherit the land. Next verse. Yet a little while, the wicked man will be no more. But, verse 11, the humble will inherit the land and will delight themselves in the abundant of prosperity. Now he goes on and he says in verse 16, better is a little of the righteous in the abundance of the wicked, but he clearly gives the contrast in verse 18. The Lord knows the days of the blameless, and their inheritance will be how long? Forever, right. But the wicked, verse 20, will perish. The end of verse 20, they vanish like smoke, they vanish away. Verse 22. Those blessed by him will inherit the land, but those cursed by him will be cut off. So, see that continued comparison and contrast. If you drop on down a little bit further, verse 27, depart from evil, do good, so you will abide forever. Right. Verse 28, for the Lord loves justice, he does not forsake his godly ones, they are preserved forever. But the descendants of the wicked, they will be cut off. The righteous will inherit the land and dwell in it forever. Right. So, verse 34, wait for the Lord, keep his ways. He will exalt you to inherit the land. The wicked will be cut off. So all the way through, he's demonstrating, okay, what you're really trying to embrace, and if you look at the beginning of chapter 37, the fact that we're fretting and really kind of envious of the evildoers, he says, what are you being envious of? What they have is not lasting. Why would you long for something that's not lasting? Why not go for that which is real? I mean, why feel bad that you don't have temporary stuff? I want to give you stuff that is forever. So why don't you go for that? So what he literally is doing is he's taking us out of, and he's taking us through an interesting journey. He's taking us through the journey of flesh, which obviously is temporary. And he's going to bring us to a spiritual. So this is temporary. This is eternal. This is the journey that he's taken us on. He's trying to get us there. Our way of thinking, our thoughts, are on the temporary. We just can't help it. What he's going to be demonstrating, if you look in chapter 38, is, obviously there's a chastening by God. Now, if you don't understand the connection, you're going to lose it. But the chastening of God is the fact that we're longing for the temporary, and we become so immersed in the temporary that we are actually feeling envious because of the fact that the wicked are attaining something that we want, and we're wanting the wrong things. The problem is not only are we wanting the wrong things, but it's making us miserable. And that's a fundamental principle, by the way. If you long for the wrong things, you're always going to be miserable. The reason why is because the wrong things never satisfy. That's a fundamental principle of Ecclesiastes. The writer of Ecclesiastes, Solomon, is saying in Ecclesiastes 2, you know, I could have anything I wanted, everything I saw, I went ahead and got. He goes, I'm still not satisfied. And that's the great frustration that comes in longing for the wrong things. But God, in his love for his children, says, I don't want you to be unsatisfied. I don't want you to be miserable. I don't want you to be angry. I don't want you to be in bitterness. I don't want you to be in anxiety over these things that really don't matter. So what God does is he takes us through the ringer. Now what has to happen is that flesh has to die in order for us to get into the realm of the spiritual. And we're going to see how this works. But if you look in particular in chapter 38, he talks about the chastening of the Lord and his burning anger against him, very first verse. You see the beginning of that. The arrows of God have sunk deep inside of him. I mean, he knows he's going through. And what's interesting about this is it is a fleshly chastening. It is conjuring up emotional anxiety. There's no doubt about that. And who doesn't, when they go through some sort of physical difficulty, who doesn't have emotional anxiety, really? I mean, it's a part of it. It stirs up all kinds of things. Probably one of the first things that comes in your mind is, not only get me out of this, but I don't deserve this. Or why doesn't he have it? Why do I have it? I mean, just so if you want to go into the whole envious thing, there's probably another one. What he begins to convey in particular in chapter 38 is that the suffering that he's going through is not only causing him to understand the concept of his own frailty, but the suffering that he's going through is also helping him understand and comprehend the limitations of his friendship and his family. There are things in this flesh, in this world, that we go to, that we perceive kind of our hope, the thing that's going to help us when we're in trouble. Sometimes we perceive that's going to be money. Other times we perceive that's going to be our family, or maybe friends, or maybe somebody close. So if you look in particular in verses 9 through 12, what is he talking about? What he's talking about is nobody wants me anymore. Now, Job was able to go through this process, in which at first, you know, we have some guys sitting around and he looks pretty sympathetic to begin with. But finally, they just can't take it anymore and they got to open their mouth, and then they start saying, you know, maybe you deserve this. And they stop being real comforters, or as Job would say, sorry comforters that you are. But they stop being comforters and they start being accusers. And the accusations just literally pour salt in the wound. Some of it, maybe in many respects, all of it probably has a sense of truth to it. But was it helping? No. And were they the ones that should be doing it? Well, absolutely not. So in this particular chapter, what he's conveying is that there is a limitation to everything. There is a limitation to what you can take physically. There is a limitation to your patience. There is a limitation to the friends that you have, the family that you have. I mean, we've all had people like Peter say, I'll always be with you. But sometimes those very same people that say, I'll always be with you, are the ones that abandon you in very seemingly innocuous times. In other words, it doesn't even have to be something tremendous. It's just that they're tired tonight and they don't want to deal with it. And you get that feeling like, well, I thought you said you were willing to help me. Yes, but I'm tired now. And this isn't even life and death stuff. Peter comes to the place, of course, with Christ, and it's a pretty scary scenario. But the point is that we all have our limitations, and the resources that we bank on have their limitations. Part of the process of the trials is to get us to see that. Because the difficulties that we have are coming about because we're anchoring in the wrong things. We're not delighting in the Lord. We're delighting in the fact that, well, I got family, or I got friends, or I have money, or I have this, and we see these as resources. It's not. It's a false hope. And every time you go back to it, it just disappoints you once again, one more time. Now, strangely enough, we've allowed ourselves to think in a rationalizing way. And though these things don't necessarily come through, we go, well, that was just today, or that just happened. But God is revealing to us, don't put your trust in this is what's making you so miserable. You're trusting in the wrong things. You're delighting in the wrong things. You're going after the wrong things. If I only have this, I only have that. He goes, that's where the sorrow and anxiety is coming from. So what God is going to do is something that none of us like. He's going to use the perfect equation to get rid of that. And it's called time and trials. The perfect equation. Time and trials. And this is why in chapter 37, we will repeat over and over again, if you look in verse 7, rest in the Lord. Now, what are we cultivating according to verse 3 of chapter 37? We're cultivating faithfulness. Okay, we're cultivating faithfulness. By the way, faithfulness is a spiritual thing. Love never fails. Okay, now abide faith, hope, and love. These three things, the greatest of these is love. Why? Love is an eternal thing. It's an eternal characteristic. Faithfulness is an eternal characteristic. God is helping us cultivate eternal characteristics. We're involved in, most of our efforts are involved in cultivating temporary things. But God says, no, we're going to get you out of that realm. Because this is what's making you so miserable. So, Cultivate faithfulness. Now, faithfulness can only be cultivated in time. And you mix it with trial, it intensifies the degree of faithfulness. This is why James will say, consider it all joy when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect result. So, time and trials. The one perfect storm that we all hate. Nobody likes to have to wait for anything. And he'll state in verse 7, rest in the Lord. What's the very next phrase after that? Wait patiently for him. Now, is God just too busy? He can't deal with us? Is God trying to torture us a little bit? You know, sort of hanging a spider over us and wanting us to, you know, squirm a little bit. It's like my brother would dangle stuff over me when he's sitting on top of me when I was, you know, beating me up, and he would just threaten me. He just loved just threatening me like that. I love my brother. But that's what brothers do. They wrestle. But he's not doing that. What is he doing? He's getting the flesh out of you. See? And it only comes out through time and trial. There's just no other equation that works this out. And we're going to see it as it goes through. But if you look once again, the humble will inherit the land in verse 11. They delight themselves in abundant prosperity. He goes on and he says, basically, you just need to wait. And it's the fundamental principle of that chapter 37. You go into chapter 38 and the trial gets intense. Now, the question often arises is, okay, wait on the Lord. What am I doing while I'm waiting? Usually, you're in a trial when you're waiting. Now, that's the truth of that. And that's why it's called waiting, because you're waiting to get out. But you shouldn't be waiting to get out. You should be waiting expectantly for him. But you're really, most of the time, waiting to get out of the trial. And it's that difficulty that is turning up the heat. In the process, if you look within the passage, it literally sucks all the strength out of you. The difficulty, I've had people say, well, you know, okay, I'm going to wait on the Lord. I'm going to wait on the Lord. What am I going to do? Well, can you wait expectantly for him when the heat's turned up? I don't know what to do. Okay, I'll tell you what to do. Say, I can hardly wait to see what he's going to do. In the midst of the most difficult moment that you can perceive in your head. Because that's what's happening within the passage. There is no soundness in my flesh. Chapter 38, verse 3. Because of thine indignation, there's no health in my bones because of my sin. My iniquity's gone over my head, obviously overwhelmed. My burden, they weigh too much for me. My wounds grow foul and fester. My skin is rotting. I'm rotting. God says, wait. So how are you feeling about that? Not too good. You want to know why? Because we're in the flesh. And the worst thing in our head is that this flesh has to suffer. That's the worst thing in our head. God says the worst thing that could ever happen to you is that you never go into the spiritual realm. The worst thing that could happen to you is that you don't go beyond protecting this flesh, and you don't go into the realm of, you know what? I need to endure to demonstrate love. And that's the worst thing that can happen to you. But we're fighting this whole thing tooth and nail. He goes on and says, as you look towards the end of chapter 38, like a deaf man, I do not hear. Dumb man does not open his mouth. What can I say? I mean, have you ever come to the end of your rope and you go, why? What? You know what else the difficult times are going to do? the difficult times as your flesh is being squeezed is going to cause you to think, maybe there is something I'm doing wrong. You know, you start off by going, I don't know why he's doing this to me. I don't deserve it. You know what time will do? Time will suffer. Have a miserable day, you'll just get angry. Have miserable days, and you'll begin to go, okay, I think I've done some things wrong. And then you start coming clean. Well, that's what happens, you know, if you look in chapter 38, verse 18, what's he going to do? I confess. I mean, you just see him putting his hands up. I confess. I'm guilty. There's something about time and trials that will reveal some things that you wouldn't be willing to come clean on had it just been a moment of difficulty, a problem that was just passing. But you go through some suffering. By the time you're like midway, you're crawling on your knees because you're starting to give up all that stuff. You know, at first you're still trying to put on airs. I think I can make it, you know. I'm just going to grit and bear it, you know. God says, well, I guess you're not humble enough. Because as you go back to 37, the humble will inherit the land. Why will the humble inherit the land? Because they understand that no good thing dwells in me and that I really need a Savior. And they begin to pour out all of those things that are standing in the way of really best in my life. Most of the time, we wrestle with things like anxiety, anger, bitterness. I mean, you can go through the list. I mean, it's all you have to do is look at the advertisements and the pills that they're selling you. I told Connie, I says, honey, you gotta see this advertisement. I said, these people are offering medication for people that have been on medication for manic depressive state. And they're saying because of that medication, they're having problems with tingling in their hands and remembering things. So they have a medication that will help them take care of the problem of this medication. So people are stressed out. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it's big business. and we know that oftentimes when we're in it, and this is the sad thing about it, and this is what I think is so exploitive, that most people when they're really immersed in it, they have no idea why they're there. So that if you walk up to them and say, you know, it's just a disease. Here's a pill. They're going to go, it's probably just a disease. And there's a pill. But it's not going to deal with the problem. It's not going to deal with the issue. See? And so the misery is still there. It's just covered up. And whatever's covering it up is now going to cause other problems. And you won't be able to cover them up unless you get another pill. But it just puts you on this journey that never fixes anything. So that the desperation that is there really is a result of not knowing what to do or how to get out of it. And, you know, I mean, have you ever just woken up one day and you go, you know, I'm just really mad. And you're not even knowing why you're mad. Or I'm just really depressed. You don't even know why you're depressed. Anxious. You know, people have anxiety attacks. If you were to ask them, what's going on here? They're going to say something like, I think I have a heart attack. I think I'm having a heart attack. Because it's going to feel just like and look just like a heart attack. But they're having an anxiety attack. And oftentimes it's an anxiety in which it didn't even happen today. It happened somewhere way back in the past. And now all of a sudden it's just popping up. Where'd that come from? The point is you don't know. What does God do? Well, you lucky dogs. Because God loves you, he's going to help you out. But it'll have to take time and trial to do it. Because even if he were to tell you right now, here's the problem, you'd go, yeah, right. But I can tell you, when you go through the difficulty, he says, here's the problem, you go, yeah, right. Because you begin to see it. I mean, it all becomes clear. That's what 39 is about. Interesting introduction, huh? That's what 39 is about. If you don't understand that, you'll miss the point of the whole song. So he's starting off by saying, okay, I'm going to guard myself. I'm going to guard my ways. I'm going to guard what I say. I'm not going to say anything. Now, what's obvious at the very beginning is that he's upset. And if you don't believe that's true, all you have to do is go down to verse 3. So if you want to jump on down to 3 and we'll cheat, you can see he's upset. So the things that he's seeing is he's upset. The question you have to ask yourself, but why is he upset? Because that's not going to be demonstrated forthright instantly. He's gonna take us through this. But what is very clear is he is upset about something. And we don't know who he's upset with, what he's upset about. We just know he's upset. And he's saying that he's afraid that if he says something, it's going to cause problems. You ever been upset? And somebody says, why don't you talk about it? And you said, well, don't you want to talk about it? Because you know, if you open your mouth, you're going to lay them low. And they're just innocent bystanders. But you're going to let them have it too. Because you're just so that upset. I said, I will guard my ways, that I might not sin with my tongue. I will guard my mouth as with a muzzle. I'm going to put it over. Especially while the wicked are in my presence. Now, the reason why he's saying that is, once again, if you understand the definition of wicked in this particular context, the wicked are those that really don't acknowledge or recognize God's existence. So they will not submit to God's ways. What he's concerned about is, if I say something in the presence of these godless people, they're going to chalk one up for their side. It's gonna mess up the cause, and it's not gonna look good for their sake, guys. So, you know what? I'm batting it down. I'm not gonna say anything. Word's gonna get out. They're gonna put on the tabloids. Pastor Gary doesn't believe in God anymore. That's see headlines. Of course, people go, Pastor who? But which is a benefit. It's a real benefit. But what you're going to see is he's concerned about this. But what's interesting is, and to me the great irony is, at this juncture, he's still not as concerned about the fact that God knows what he's thinking as how it's going to play out in the external world. I mean, obviously God knows that he's fuming. Shouldn't the worst, the psalmist will say in Psalm 51, against thee and thee alone have I sinned. But that's not what we're seeing in this passage. Okay, I'm not going to say anything. Why aren't you going to say anything? Well, the kids. The kids are in the room. I'm not going to say anything. Well, in this particular context, well, the ungodly people who are in the room, it's somehow going to mess everything up. Everybody has a reason why there. Well, come on, just say what you feel. Not going to do it. I was dumb and silent. I couldn't say anything. I couldn't even say anything. Remember your mom? If you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. And I remember telling my mom, well, I can't say anything nice, so forget about it. And, you know, there are those moments where it's just better not to say anything. But then you find yourself isolating yourself from being a help or a benefit or to anybody. Now, you're doing this all under the name of, you know, I got to protect the reputation of God, but you're not doing anything good. So I don't know. How does that work? I refrained even from good. I thought if I just don't do something, if I just do nothing, it'll go away. Does it go away? It doesn't go away. It does not go away. See, this is where depression comes from, right? Take that anger, suppress it, turns inward. It doesn't go away. Your sorrow, your pain, it just, and what's interesting within the context is he's not only talking about a physical pain, but an emotional sorrow. And so the word is really used in both parts of the camp. Both things are happening at the same time. My heart was hot within me, burning, would probably be inflamed, would probably be another way of putting it. While I was musing, the fire burned. Musing is an interesting term in that it describes a thinking. Oftentimes it draws on the imagination. Where does your imagination go when you're angry? You don't even want to go there, do you? Because you're thinking up things. You go, oh, I didn't even know I would think about that. But you're thinking up things that you should never think about with that imagination. What's also interesting is that the word is also tied to growling. You know that. His musing. The fire burned. You kind of get a picture. You ever like thrown a bunch of leaves on a fire and it just kind of almost looked like it went out. And then it was kind of simmering, and all of a sudden, that's what this picture is. He just couldn't help it. While I was musing, the fire burned. Then I spoke with my tongue. You can just hear. Finally, it came out. Verse 4, when he uses the phrase that I spoke, he's making an effort. The word spoke in the Hebrew here in the text is making reference to putting things in order. And he's making an effort to say, okay, let's ground level this thing. And I would say, you know, that's pretty helpful to go back to theology and, okay, what is God doing? Now, at this juncture, I'm going to introduce to you why he's angry. He is angry at God because God is turning up the heat on him. We know that's true in chapter 38. It is a tie over from that. And he's going to talk about that. He's going to talk about it in this chapter. So we know it's God. When something physical is happening to you, it sort of takes your mind off of other things. And you just become focused on whatever that misery is. It has an uncanny way of doing it. And if you're going to say to me, it really doesn't do that, I would say, then you haven't suffered enough. But if you've suffered enough, you know what I'm talking about. So you come in this realm of pain, and now you're clearly focused. And now you're beginning to go, okay, God, what are you doing? And you're also coming to terms with, as we were talking about, your limitations and the end of you, your insignificance. Strangely enough, until you come to the end of your rope, you're not even thinking how insignificant you truly are. But I could just hear him kind of rehearse it in his mind. Okay, God, let's go through this. I'm really insignificant, aren't I? So we pick up in chapter 39 and verse 4. Lord, make me to know my end. Now, there's a lot of ways that you can take that word know. Yada is in the Hebrew. In this particular context, it is defined as acknowledge. So let's read it that way. Lord, help me to acknowledge that I have an end. You see, Psalm 49 talks about the wealthy and they think that their lands are forever. We know that youth perceives that they're going to live forever. It's not until everything starts shutting down and failing that you go, you know what? I don't think I'm going to live forever. And it really is, in many respects, the grace of God that allows you to the longevity of seeing this. Because had you not had the time, in other words, had you just been, and this is one of the things, this is one of the, go back to Psalm 37, the wicked are what? Cut off. Lucky you. You get to suffer. But the wonderful thing about suffering is you get to think it over. And you get to come to the right conclusions if you'll do this right. Now, you could sit in the corner of a room and go, get me out of here, get me out of here, get me out of here, get me out. And, you know, it's not going to work. And you're just going to be miserable. And you're going to come through the end of this and find no benefit at all. Or you could start going through it like he's doing. So he's taking us through and he says, Lord, make me, it's a causative text, cause me to acknowledge that I have an end. And cause me, still causative in the text, to realize the extent of my days. And the word extent there is a very interesting term in the sense that it's actually taken from clothing. It's an interesting picture of like a robe that's placed on somebody. When you look at Isaiah chapter 6, and Isaiah gets to see God, and he sees the train just flowing through. You imagine just a train flowing through the universe. Well, in many respects, the longer the train, the more respectable and honorable and glorious the person. So his point is, how long is my train? Help me to realize how important I really am. It's really what the passage is saying. The extent of my days, what will I accomplish in these times? How important is that? Days is an allotted period of time that you and I have. Help me to acknowledge, what's the significance of what you've accomplished in your days? Help me to acknowledge how significant I really am and what I really can accomplish in the period of time that I have. Let me know how transient I am. How I cease to be would be another way of putting it. He's coming to terms with something. Obviously, he's not seeing himself as perhaps as great as he thought he was. Trials and time will reveal our limitations in our flesh. Time and trials will reveal the superficiality of friends and of that other hope that you've placed in other things or people. It'll help you see their limitations as well. You and I are cultivating forever. Forever means that we're cultivating something more than just getting out of a situation or getting into another one. We're becoming faithful. That's a different journey. Behold, verse 5, thou hast made my days as handbreadths. Best picture of that, Jeremiah, I guess 52:21, where it actually defines handbreadth, these four fingers. It's the smallest measurement. Cubic would be from here to here, but the smallest measurement is handbreadths. He says, okay, my days aren't even a cubit. It's the smallest measurement, my days. It's an interesting way of putting it. Which I think one of the reasons why he puts it this way, of course, what's interesting is all the measurements that you see in Scripture are taken from the human body. And God is reminding us through that. And my lifetime, or the duration of my life would probably be the best way of putting it, is as nothing in thy sight. Probably more correctly translated, it would sound something like this. And the duration of my life is whatever it means to you. I mean, his point is that it could be small, it could be long, it could be however long you want it, but it's not in my hands. Surely every man, use the word Adam in this, Adam, surely every man at his best is a mere Habel. That's where we get the name Abel. It's just, what do you need him for? Just worthless, right? Just a breath. He takes a break here, right, Selah? He takes a break, and you can hear him pondering the reality of what he's stating. I mean, I'm coming to terms with my mortality, he's saying. I'm not sure I could even make it. Obviously, I don't control anything. Surely. Okay, now he's... the more he thinks about it, the more he's stirred up about this. Surely every man walks about as a phantom. He uses a term that is descriptive of an idol. And the best way I can describe it, it would be an empty image. It's an empty image. What can the image do? Nothing. Surely they make an uproar for nothing. Now, the word uproar here is meant to parallel, you remember his murmurings? Okay. His growling. Surely he growls for nothing. You're upset. God's looking down at us. I was talking to Connie today, and she said, God was showing me something in a passage, and he told me this, and I said, honey, I don't think God's that snarky. You know, sometimes we have a certain persona of how, I said, I think he would say it like Jesus would say it. but what you can see God saying within the text is, so what have you been growling about? There are things that just upset us, that anger us, we muse over it, we grumble over, we're complaining, we're gritting our teeth, you got to go to the dentist, get that stuff filled in, because you're so angry. God says, what are you so angry about? You know why you're angry. You're not angry because you didn't have a greater godly character today. That's not why you're angry. You're angry over something very superficial, very surface, very insignificant. That's why you're angry. And God's going to show you how insignificant it is. If it takes all the time in the world, if it takes all the trials in the world, he's going to show you just how insignificant your anger is.
Gary,
yes, sir.
Real quickly, so in the first part, 1 through 5, he's holding back his anger, his frustration, but then he lets it out and recognizes, am I right in saying that he recognizes, okay, gosh, it's so insignificant. Why did I do that?
No, I wouldn't say he recognizes it. I would say he's walking through it. That is to say, you get angry and you say, okay, I shouldn't be angry at my wife. She's really a nice person. She's been very kind to me. What are some more reasons? You're trying to talk yourself out of the anger. And so he's kind of walking himself through. Okay, God's like forever, I'm not. I get it. So the reason why it says then he spoke, and he uses that word, he starts putting things in order. He's now kind of in a list. And he's kind of giving himself reason. Right. Okay, so verse 6, surely every man walks about as a phantom, he's just an empty image. Surely they make an uproar for nothing. Nothing is accomplished. I mean, when's the last time you roared and it accomplished something? He amasses riches. This is an interesting term that he puts in here. Just give you an interesting passage, a couple of them. And we're doing this for Don's sake. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, if you look with me. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, just read verse 8 with me. There was a certain man without a dependent. You with me? Chapter 4, verse 8. There was a certain man without a dependent, having neither son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all of his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, so why am I doing this? Why am I working so hard? Why am I depriving myself of breaks? This too is vanity, and it's a grievous thing. Look in chapter 5, if you look with me, in verse 13. There's a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment, oh, that'll never happen. And he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. What Ecclesiastes is saying is that you're amassing riches and you don't know what's going to happen. If you look at Ecclesiastes 6, just pick up in verse 1. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun. It is prevalent among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, but God has not allowed him to enjoy them. God has not empowered him to eat of them. Foreigner comes in, he enjoys them. You go, well, that's bizarre. He's worked hard all his life for something, and he can't even enjoy it. I've seen people do that. I've seen people who work all their life for retirement and then they die. They can't even spend it. Of course, you can't think of this particular passage without thinking of Luke 12, where the rich man says, I'm going to tear down my barns, going to build bigger barns. He says, you fool, this very night, your soul's going to be required of you. So anyway, he says this in chapter 39, verse 6. He amasses riches. The best way to describe that would be he stores them up. He's somehow storing up or heads up riches and does not know who will gather them. He doesn't know how this is going to end up. He knows he's storing stuff. He just doesn't know how it's going to be allocated. He doesn't know how it's going to be spent. He doesn't know anything about it. The verse is all about the fact that you don't control anything. And he comes to the realization, I don't control anything. And he's walking through this. So he's walking through, okay, God's like forever, I'm not. He can feel his life even slipping away as he speaks. He realizes that a breath, eternity is a breath away, really. And that whatever he's done, the phrase, if you look in verse 6, surely every man walks about, it's in the reflexive, which means he's just walking around. He walks himself around. Let's be the picture of the reflexive. He's just walking himself around. What are you doing? I'm walking around. Where are you going? Around. It's an interesting picture. So, verse 7. And now, Lord, what am I waiting for? What are most of us waiting for when we're going through difficulties? Out, right? Out of the difficulties. Something's changed. He's not asking for an out. He's asking for God. There's a big difference. Go back to Psalm 37. Delight yourself in the Lord. What's keeping us from delighting ourselves in the Lord? You're envious of temporary stuff. You're just so upset. You're upsetting yourself. And this is why I'd like to delight myself on God. I'm just not happy. Well, I can tell you why you're not happy. Because you're immersed in the things of the world. Well, I don't know how I can get out of that. God knows how you can get out of that. It's called time and trial. Fasten seatbelts. If you're a child of God, you're going to go through it. What happens? Well, I can tell you what happens. What happens is not only has your whole perspective changed, not only have you realized the limitations of yourself and others and your hopes and your aspirations, not only do you realize the ridiculousness of pursuing things that could matter so little. Why was I so mad about that? Come close to death. Be safe from that death. Go up with the microphone to that person and say, what's important? I mean, if they lost their house, if they lost everything that particular day they may have been full of anxiety over, but on that day, they came to an understanding. None of it matters. Unfortunately, sometimes it can't happen in just a flash. It has to happen through the pain. Now, Lord, what do I wait? Who do I long for would be another way of putting it. It goes back to delight yourself in the Lord, right? Who do I long for? It's you. It's you. You're the only one lasting in all of this. My hope is in thee. Deliver me from all my transgressions. What's he talking about? I should have never loved these things. That's what was making me miserable. I should have never loved these things. Transgressions is almost always within the context of a sense of rebelliousness against God. And I was fighting against you because I was loving other things other than you. Deliver me from these things. Make me not a reproach of the foolish. Don't let me be held in contempt before the foolish people that love these things. Oh, he doesn't have anything. I have become dumb. I do not open my mouth. Why didn't he open his mouth at the very beginning of the chapter? Why didn't he open his mouth? Why? He's upset. So sheer resolve, he wouldn't open his mouth, right? That's not what this text says. Why wouldn't he open his mouth? God wouldn't let him. Difficulties have a way of silencing us. There is an arrogance that we breed in feeling like we're in control. Oftentimes, when we first get hit by that difficulty, we're going to say something. You know what God's going to do? He's going to increase it so you don't say anything. He goes, I thought it was me holding back. You wouldn't let me talk. You kept me from saying things that I felt, from hurting myself and from hurting others. You kept me from doing this because you knew it was on my heart. The trials and the difficulties that come in your flesh will humble you. They will humble you. Every knee will bow. I have become dumb. I do not open my mouth because it is thou who hast done it. Verse 10. Who put the plague on him? Remove thy plague from me. Because of the opposition of thy hand, I am perishing. Who's doing it? God is doing it. With reproofs, thou dost chasten. Now, when he uses the term plague, a good description of plague can also be strokes or beatings. The picture is almost always a kind of flesh wound. What is he beating down? The flesh. Why is he beating it down? Because that's what we take pride in. That's what we hold our hope in. That's what we believe is going to bring us the greatest joy. But it's not. It's bringing us the greatest misery. And it's strange to think that through going through one of the greatest trials that you could ever go through, you would come out feeling better than you ever felt before. That the trial was necessary for you to get out of this strange place that you're in, waking up every day feeling so miserable and full of anxiety. And God goes, you want anxiety? I'll give you anxiety. You want something to think about? I'll give you something to think about. And it's the difficulty and the pain that takes your mind off of. And then somebody walks up to you and says, remember what you were angry about last week? And you go, what? And they say, they begin to describe to you, and they go, well, I hadn't even been thinking about that. Why? Because I'm just trying to live. I'm just trying to breathe tomorrow. That's what I'm hoping to do. If I can make it tomorrow, that would be great. And I'm not even sure I feel like making it tomorrow. But what is God doing? He's flushing out all the insignificant things in your life. Don't you wish there was an easier way? I wish there was an easier way. Remove thy plague from me because of the opposition of thy hand. I'm perishing. With reproofs, thou dost chasten me. You're correcting me. God's not just beating you up. He's correcting you. From doing what? From wasting your life. You can invest in forever today. You know what you're thinking about? You're angry and upset about temporary. And it's just going to make you more upset the longer you're in that realm. But because you chasten me, you help me see something. Now, this is a very interesting phrase here. Verse 11. With reproofs that is chasten a man for iniquity. Iniquity would be for his perversity. Man, am I twisted in my thinking? This is really important. It's funny. It's funny watching people. What's really important to them? It's so funny. It's comical. Really? You think that's important? There's something about the chastening that helps you, will help you get back your equilibrium, and you go, okay, that's not important. This is important. And it just levels everything off, doesn't it? So he says, you chasten me, watch the phrase, thou dost consume as a moth what is precious to him. I love that phrase. He'll use a similar phrase, by the way, it's in Psalm 6, if you'll look with me. Keep your finger there. But if you look in Psalm 6, if you look in verse 7, my eye has wasted away with grief. It has become old because of all my adversaries. The picture of the passage is coming to the end of your life in an old age. Things begin to shrink. So that particular word is actually moth is in that particular text. My eye's wasting away. It's a mothing. Moth is eating it. The picture is that your body is shrinking and it's becoming diminished. It's becoming weaker. Where did I go? What happened? I'm getting smaller. So, was that Wicked Witch of the West? I don't know. But see, most of you wouldn't know about that. But it's an interesting descript of like a moth eating. I mean, you don't see it right away, and then all of a sudden you have a hole in the garment. Where did that come from? You don't even know where it came from. You know what time and trials do? They eat away at you. But they don't just eat away at you. They eat away at everything that you value. Think about the things that are very important to you. Okay, now tomorrow, get really, really sick. Start losing your faculties. Start watching your body deteriorate. How important is that new car? It's like a moth ate it up. You go, it's not important. And you're watching things go around. Oh, we need to have this done and we need to do that. How important is that? It doesn't even matter anymore. It doesn't even matter anymore. He says, God has a way of eating away everything that has value. You say, well, why does he use a moth to do it? Why didn't he just drag it off? Because it would be so sudden that you wouldn't have time to think about it. But the process of the time is causing you to reflect and you go, I'm watching my life leave me. And God goes, there's still time. There's still time. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about this process. There's still time. The wicked are cut off, but for you, there's still time. And you're watching these things go, and you go, well, his statement is, thou dost consume as a moth what is precious to him. Surely every man is a mere breath. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I am a stranger with thee. Things have changed. Listen to what he's saying. God, you, me, this isn't our home, is it? I can just see the Father going, nope, this isn't our home. I got it. This isn't my home. The way he ends this, to me, it's a great text because it's like this. Okay, I got it. So can I be happy again for the rest of my life? He goes, now you can really be happy. Because now these things aren't necessary to make you happy. Now they're just the extra benefits. I mean, God has given us all things to freely enjoy, right? They're not bad. But it's when we put our trust in these things that make us miserable, when we go after them so hard, and that's the desire of our heart that makes us so upset and angry. Somebody else is getting something, and we wake up so angry and so upset and so afraid that something's going to be taken away from us. So what? So what? You go through something like this, you go, so what? I'm alive. He brought me out of this, and he's got something good for me. My trust is in him. And you're able to enjoy the rest of your life. I mean, look how he ends. Look, as long as you're looking at me favorably, I'm okay. Turn thy gaze away from me that I may smile again before I depart and am no more. Let these last days be joyful days. At the very end of the text, he's actually telling you what the problem was. He wasn't happy. And he had to go through misery to find that out. That's bizarre, isn't it? A lot of people aren't happy. They're walking around. They're amassing things. They're storing things. It's in their attic. It's in their closet. It's in their garage. They don't know why. They don't know who's going to, you know, that later on they ask their kids, you want those? I don't want those. It's outdated. So they don't know why they're doing what they're doing. They just know that this is what you do. And their whole life is spent doing these kind of things. And they find themselves, I mean, they find their life miserable, and they don't even, it's just this misery that just keeps breeding in their heart. They don't know why. God is good to us, isn't he? The psalmist is revealing to us that if you're going through difficulty, and you will, it's a good thing. Father, we give you thanks for your love for us, in that you don't just cut us off. You help us learn. And you help us learn what is really valuable, and you help us learn what is really important. And most of all, you help us learn that you never fail us. That we can trust in you. And that we're really just strangers and aliens in this land. We don't belong here. We're not looking for the things that the world is looking for. We're looking for things like integrity and joy and peace. Oh yeah, faithfulness and love. Lord, get us out of these deep places of depression and anxiety and anger and bitterness. Take us out of this. If it takes time and trials, so be it. But maybe, Father, just maybe, it won't take that, because you've shown us in your word all we need to do. Thank you for revealing this to us in your name. Amen.